Carbon credits are meant to help you offset your emissions by investing in green projects, but many of them are fraudulent.
I was one of the first people to really do a market-wide survey of carbon credits. And what I found was really disturbing.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. The reality of carbon trading. Also, 3 years ago, Russian mercenaries went to West Africa to fight terrorism. That's not how things worked out with the Wagner Group in Mali.
So it's really leading to chaos. Wagner has been an agent of chaos in Mali.
Plus, rugby is a rough game with lots of concussions.
It's a common enough problem for the sport of rugby, just because of the physical high collision nature of the sport.
A small, high-tech piece of gear aims to address the problem. That's all ahead today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We are glad to be with you today.
If you're like me, you get a little boost when you get home and see a package waiting on your doorstep. Well, you might be getting fewer of them for a little while.
Some foreign postal services are hitting pause on deliveries to the United States because this Friday, a customs tax rule that allowed businesses to avoid import tariffs for low-value goods comes to an end. It's called the de minimis exemption, and President Trump is getting rid of it.
We asked Andy Wu at the Harvard Business School to break it all down for us, starting with which countries have suspended postal deliveries to the U.S.
We are seeing countries like Japan and Switzerland, Australia, Austria, Belgium, Finland, France, Germany, India, Italy, Norway, Spain, Sweden, Denmark, pausing their shipments. And it is going to change the nature of retailing and obviously our shipment process to the United States.
Also, DHL, a major international shipper, has also paused shipments, right?
Yes, that's right. So we're seeing pausing of shipments both from government postal services as well as from private shipping businesses.
And this is directly related to the new tariffs that would go into effect on Friday, right?
Absolutely. The tariffs are creating a great deal of uncertainty for these postal services. And the safe thing for them is to pause their shipments. The current shipments they have en route to the United States, the challenge is that they haven't collected the import duties necessary for those shipments to clear into the United States. And they haven't asked for the reporting requirements from the shippers, their customers, to know exactly what's in the packages so they can properly fulfill the requirements upon entry.
So they don't have the systems in place to collect these tariffs. So they're just pausing shipments until they do. Is that right?
Exactly. So there's two issues. One issue is that they don't have the systems in place. And there's also a great deal of uncertainty. As we've seen in the last few months, it's unclear that any particular tariff regime is going to hold into the future. If these postal services knew for certain that these tariffs were going to hold on de minimis products, then I think they would be much faster here about adjusting those systems.
So I think you said something like this is going to change e-commerce. Can you tell me what you mean?
Certainly in the short term, the pause by these postal services is going to slow down or temporarily block various retailers overseas from shipping in small goods into the United States. So anyone who's currently or thinking about ordering one of those small products, you might want to wait for a bit. That said, the bigger picture here is whether or not these tariffs are going to hold on de minimis products going forward. If that were the case, that's going to reduce the competitiveness of the e-commerce environment and reduce the bevy of goods and increase the price of those goods for the U.S. consumer.
What reason has the Trump administration given for making this move?
The Trump administration has made a variety of arguments. One of the principal arguments is that these de minimis packages, of which there are many coming into the United States every day, are potentially a channel for the importation of illegal goods. Because there's so many of these small packages, the government can't possibly inspect all of the small packages. So the argument has been made that these packages may contain illicit goods like narcotics and such. But as a much broader narrative here, we are talking about the question of whether or not international trade more generally is good for Americans. Certainly good for the American consumer, perhaps not so good or has some challenges for the American worker.
So it sounds like all of these postal services stopping shipment to the U.S. is probably going to be a temporary problem, but the longer impact on how we in the U.S. buy things is going to be from this tariff being levied. Is that your understanding?
if the current tariff policy were to hold, then the pause by these postal services is absolutely a temporary thing. I'm confident the postal services around the world will figure out how to manage the tariffs and do the reporting requirements. However, in a scenario where these tariff policies were to change constantly from month to month, then we might be in a situation like this for a while.
If these tariffs do remain, what does it mean for American consumers? Are we just all paying those tariffs when we buy things online from abroad?
So the importer will be paying the tariffs, but most economists would say that that will manifest as higher prices for the U.S. consumer. Certainly, what it will do is reduce the ability of foreign e-commerce businesses to compete for the U.S. consumer. In general, economic theory would suggest that that would increase prices and decrease the selection and quality of goods for the U.S. consumer.
Andy Wu teaches business administration at the Harvard Business School. He's been speaking with us about why a host of foreign postal services have stopped sending low-cost parcels to the U.S.
The early rounds of the Women's Rugby World Cup are underway, and so far there's been a series of blowout wins by England, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa.
For the first time since 2010, South Africa's women have a victory at a Rugby World Cup.
As we reported last week, this is the biggest Women's World Cup rugby has ever seen. There are new teams, new broadcast deals, and record-sized crowds.
But there's also a new piece of equipment that players are wearing. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Even if you've never played rugby before, you probably know it's a very physical sport.
A blindside flanker taken in a good tackle by Bavin Parsons. Short of the line as well, they'll dig it out once more. Lot of bodies.
With parts of the game called scrums, rucks, and mauls, which even sound pretty rough, contact is an integral part of rugby. Like many sports, it can lead to a number of injuries. One of the most serious ones is a concussion.
Concussion is obviously incredibly serious. It's absolutely our number one priority, understanding why they happen and doing what we can to reduce that.
Lindsay Starling is a science and medical manager at World Rugby, the sport's global governing body. In an interview with Sky News, she was transparent about the fact that the sport has a high risk of injury.
And so that can't be ignored. We can't pretend that the sport is incredibly safe.
So Starling and her team at World Rugby have introduced a new tool to help, a mouth guard made high tech. Here's how it works. If a player gets hit hard enough to potentially cause a concussion, their mouth guard will start flashing red. Data is sent directly to medics, the referee stops play, and the player goes off for a head injury assessment. Starling explained more on Instagram.
The mouth guard lighting up immediately on impact means that there is no delay to the player being seen, and it also creates more awareness amongst players, amongst fans, amongst match officials, that they can see that the players had a suspected head knock.
Catherine Dane says she would have worn the new mouth guard if it had been around during her time on Ireland's national team. She had three diagnosed concussions during her rugby career and retired from professional sport just last year.
The majority of them occur from tackle events. It's a common enough problem for the sport of rugby just because of the physical high collision nature of the sport.
Dane now researches tackle safety in women's rugby at the University of Calgary. She thinks the flashing red mouth guards are a good idea because often concussions can be a hidden injury. Players don't often look hurt unless they're stumbling, which Dane says is often not the case. Damian Bailey agrees that the new mouth guards could be really useful, particularly in raising awareness among fans. He studies how rugby impacts the brain at the University of South Wales.
Some people think you've got to hit the head in order to induce these types of forces. But no, you don't have to go anywhere near the head to impact the brain. You know, you can hit the torso.
World Rugby declined an interview request for this story, but at a press conference, competition director Yvonne Nolan said the new mouth guards have already started flashing at the tournament.
We had 6 alerts, of which 3 were unique. So that means that there was no other sign or indicator that a player needed to be removed for HIA.
A head injury assessment.
So that shows that they're working. That shows that this technology is giving us another tool that we can use to make sure that the players are as safe as they can possibly be.
Officials say every player at the World Cup right now has opted in to wearing the high-tech mouth guards, apart from two athletes who have braces. After this World Cup, the mouth guards will roll out across men's and women's elite rugby and other leagues, including the NFL, NHL, and Australian rules football, are interested in the technology. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Istanbul is a sprawling metropolis of some 16 million people. Near the center, there is a forest full of fruit trees. Visitors can harvest whatever they like for free. As the world's Duri Buscarin reports, this style of community gardening is attracting a lot of new interest around the globe. But it has roots in an old way of life.
It's actually a really hot, muggy summer day in Istanbul today, and the temperature just drops when you get here. There's like a breeze and all of the shade. The Ulus Fruit Garden is planted on a long, steep hill, maintained by the city. It's about 7 acres, with tall canopies of cherry, fig, and apple trees stretching over a raised wooden walkway that makes it easier to pick fruit straight from the trees. The falling fruit might occasionally attract rodents, but an exceedingly friendly tuxedo cat seems to be keeping them in check. This is the best time of year, says Erdal Sezener, who lives nearby and walks here regularly. There are black mulberries, pears, apples, even wild cherries, called taflan. A big sign invites people to taste the fruit, but asks that they leave some for others. Even so, sometimes people come with bags to fill, Sezener says. There are a few complaints like that.
Concept bence çok güzel.
I think it's a beautiful concept, he says. Humans have long tended collective orchards, says Samed Akman, who co-founded the Tilia Ecological Cooperative. Some still exist today.
It is designed by mimicking nature.
Desert oases in Morocco draw together banana trees, date palms, and herb gardens. Tropical forests built by Mesoamerican civilizations have tall nut trees alongside avocado, papaya, and squash. In the 18th century, the mother of an Ottoman sultan commissioned a public orchard in Istanbul, planting trees from all corners of the empire and allowing anyone to pick the fruit.
And it was really big. Nobody knows how big it was.
The Valide Bağ Grove lives on today as a public park. Walking through, you'll occasionally see wild pears, probably the descendants of pear trees planted there long ago. In the 20th century, as many countries turned to industrial farming to feed rapidly growing cities, a lot of these urban food sources were lost.
One of the beauties of food forest is recreating that relationship.
Naeem Edwards is director of the Michigan State University Urban Farm in Detroit. There are more than 90 food forests across the United States. Similar projects are gathering interest and public funding in the European Union and Brazil.
For people to be able to connect directly with nature and see nature and a tree and the outdoors as a source of food rather than simply being completely reliant on stores and processed foods.
The trees sequester carbon, clean the air, and bear fruit, and they don't have to be part of a big community gardening project.
There's now just a greater intentionality to integrate fruit and nut crops into streetscapes, parks, public properties.
In Istanbul, green space is a rapidly diminishing resource. Everything around us is urbanized, says Nuray Orhan, a nanny who lives near the Ulus Fruit Garden. She says she brings the children she takes care of, so the little ones can see how different fruits grow, how some mulberries are sweet, but the unripe ones are sour. In September, the figs start to come in, then the pomegranates and the quinces. It reminds her of her hometown on the Black Sea. This place is something that saves us, she says. It's a place where you can breathe. For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. It is an old story, like really old. Homer's Odyssey, chronicling a warrior's long journey home from battle.
The British-American filmmaker Christopher Nolan is turning the Odyssey into a new action movie starring Matt Damon. It's supposed to be due out next summer, and it's still in production. But the film project has taken an unexpected turn that has nothing to do with the plot. Nolan shot scenes in Dakhla, a city in Western Sahara that's been under occupation by Morocco for the past 50 years. That has meant that the indigenous Sahrawi people in Western Sahara are in exile, many in neighboring Algeria.
Now, an annual film festival that spotlights the work of the Sahrawi people has called on Nolan to denounce the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara. Maria Carrion is the executive director of that festival, known as Fi Sahara. She's based in Madrid. I asked her why Western Sahara was picked as a location for this film.
That's a very good question that we are asking Mr. Nolan and Universal Pictures to clarify. We do not know. How come they ended up in occupied Dakhla, in a militarized city within a militarized and occupied territory? So we have already issued statements asking for clarification and not heard back.
All right. So your festival, Fi Sahara, has urged Nolan to recognize that there's more to Dakhla than cinematic sand dunes. You said it's first and foremost an occupied and militarized city. So for our listeners who may not know the politics of the region, explain that.
Western Sahara is a territory that is between Morocco and Mauritania. And first, my country, Spain, colonized it for around a century. And then in 1975, as Africa was decolonizing, Spain entered into an agreement with Morocco to the north and Mauritania to the south and allowed for this invasion to take place. It was a very violent invasion. It was also settler invasion because hundreds of thousands of Moroccans were encouraged to go to Western Sahara and settle there. And for 50 years, half of the indigenous people of Western Sahara, the Sahrawi, have been under this brutal occupation. The other half, they had their own, let's say, odyssey. They had to flee into the desert. They were bombed with white phosphorus bombs from the sky with French warplanes. And they ended up in Algeria, where our festival takes place in exile.
What is life like for Sahrawis in exile today? What is their current situation on a day-to-day practical level?
It's dire. I mean, they're in a part of the Sahara, that desert known as the Hamada, the desert of deserts, where right now in the middle of the summer, it might get up to 55 Celsius, very extreme weather conditions. They're in refugee camps. Humanitarian aid is dwindling at this point, has been cut, slashed. Food aid has been slashed by over 75%. So there's malnutrition in the camps. You have an actual government in exile known as the SADR, recognized by quite a few countries around the world and a founding member of the African Union. So even though Sahrawis in exile depend on humanitarian aid, their homeland being very rich in natural resources that they don't have access to because they're being plundered by Morocco and its allies.
Now, you said that filming in Western Sahara contributes to Morocco's repression of the territory and actually whitewashes Morocco's occupation of it. Explain.
Well, Morocco is trying to normalize its occupation and basically just it be a de facto sovereignty over Western Sahara. In order to do that, it has to invest in the kinds of activities and industries that would attract international investors. So it's everything from agriculture to renewable energy to fishing, all kinds of plunder is going on, but there's also cultural plunder. And when Nolan and his team were filming in Dakhla, the Moroccan Minister of Culture went to see them. There's photographs of Mohamed Mehdi, the minister, meeting with Christopher Nolan.
Do you believe Christopher Nolan and his team were unwittingly complicit, or is this part of a broader pattern of film productions overlooking the geopolitical implications of where they're shooting?
It's a very good question. It's a question we want him to answer. There's a chance that they were bamboozled into this because they were shooting in Morocco and other parts of Morocco. So maybe they were offered the chance to go to southern Morocco, as the occupier calls it, and that there's a beautiful sand dune known as the White Sand Dune. Definitely, whatever happened, there was no due diligence done on the shoot on the part of the production team.
Morocco has really pushed its own Moroccan film production locations in recent years. It sounds like the opening of the doors to Western Sahara is just part of its active film production marketing.
Yes, but also primarily it's a strategy to attract foreign investment and make occupied Western Sahara a normal place to visit. Already it's a tourist location, and none of these properties and none of the money is going to the rightful owners of this land. And so to me, it seems like it's not just innocently saying, oh, we want Morocco to be the site of these great productions. It's actually doing it in Western Sahara, which Morocco has no right over, according to international law.
So your festival, Fi Sahara, works closely with the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, but also the Polisario Front, which is a group committed to armed resistance against Morocco. How do you respond to criticisms of the Polisario Front, including allegations of human rights abuses, extremist links, and also calls to label it a terrorist organization?
So we work alongside both the government in exile and the Polisario Front, which is a liberation movement. Polisario Front and the part that we work with are diplomats who we have to coordinate with, because when we go, when we travel to the refugee camps, we are going into a militarized part of Algeria. This is Algerian territory. And then on to the refugee camps, we must be escorted by the Algerians and then by the Sahrawis. And so in terms of working side by side with them, we have to, like anyone else, like UNICEF, like all of the humanitarian organizations that work in the refugee camps, they work with the Polisario Front.
Mm. So returning to The Odyssey, the film that's currently in production, you are awaiting replies from Christopher Nolan and his team for more details and how this shoot happened in Western Sahara in the first place. What exactly are you asking of the production team, and what outcome would you like to see going ahead for filmmakers?
So first, they need to break their silence, and they need to give a full explanation to the Sahrawi people, and especially Sahrawi at-risk filmmakers and human rights defenders and journalists, don't get the red carpet treatment as he did. So that's number one. We want to hear from them what happened. Then admit that it was wrong to film in an occupied territory, and also do not use the footage. Do not use those scenes filmed in those sand dunes. That's plundered cinema, basically, or ask for consent from the rightful owners of that land. And also, I think he's aware now, being told that he's aware of this, but to educate himself. It was a really terrible wrong, and I'm hearing constantly from activists, either under occupation or who had to flee, that they are just furious that this happened. And it is a chance for him to perhaps meet some of them, learn about it, and use this very powerful platform to shed light on what is happening in Western Sahara.
Maria Carrion is the executive director of Fi Sahara, an annual film festival that spotlights the work of the Sahrawi people of Western Sahara. She's based in Madrid. We reached out to representatives for Christopher Nolan and Universal Pictures. They did not respond to our request for comment.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org. www.theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. If you are flying anywhere these days, you might have been offered the option of buying a carbon offset when you pay for your plane tickets. It's presented as a way to support renewable energy or forestry projects to offset the carbon emissions from the flight that you're taking.
Deutsche Welle's Kathleen Schuster flies regularly between Germany and the U.S., and seeing this offer at checkout got her thinking about whether carbon offsets actually work. She looked into that for DW's environment podcast, Living Planet. Here is Kathleen.
A few years ago, Elias Erey stepped into the world of carbon markets, thinking he knew what the problems were. He just finished his PhD in forest science in Maine and then got a job with a carbon broker.
And my role at that broker was essentially to evaluate projects that we were looking to broker and figure out if they were good or bad. And the broker that I worked for put a lot of effort into figuring out if the credits were good or bad.
A carbon broker buys and sells carbon credits. Essentially, Elias thought the problem with carbon credits was a technological one. Better technology would mean better offsetting, or so he thought.
And so in my role there, I think I was one of the first people in the markets to really do a really market-wide survey of carbon credits that were floating around out there. And what I found was really disturbing.
He says about half of the projects that came through were low quality, and in some cases, the projects were selling bad credits, really bad credits.
People knew that there was bad stuff happening inside these projects. It just wasn't being reported on. So one of the earliest projects that we looked at had massive amounts of deforestation inside of it. And this is a project that was designed around conserving the forest.
Where?
In Brazil. So it was the edge of the Amazon rainforest. What happened essentially was that a large project developer enrolled a lot of community land, and the community didn't really have the capacity to stop deforestation in and around its community. And the police in the community had no intention of putting their lives on the line to stop deforestation. And so essentially that project had failed to stop deforestation, and yet its credits were still and still are circulating around.
They're still circulating.
Oh, yes. Very few carbon projects have ever been canceled following a scandal. In fact, single digits.
So if I were to find some great project in the Amazon rainforest that says that they're helping preserve the forest, and I think, great, I can offset a flight, I'm going to do this, it could actually be the case that it hasn't done anything, that it's actually been deforested.
Yes, that happens quite frequently, that the trees are already cut down, and they just haven't reported it and probably never will. Having come to that conclusion, I was really shocked, and I wanted people to know that a lot of these carbon credits that they were buying weren't having the impact that they thought they were. Because at the end of the day, I do think of myself as a climate scientist. I mean, I have a PhD in this space, and I'm not here necessarily to broker credits. I'm here to have an impact on climate change.
So then Elias does a 180. He leaves the carbon broker firm, and he also starts putting himself out there on YouTube.
Carbon credit contract lengths make no sense. And I'm not just talking about the obvious, but let's go ahead and start
separate videos that nobody watches. So I want to dump all of the ways in which people can cheat in forest carbon projects into a single...
Because that I'm just some carbon, just some tubular carbon. And
to be fair, he doesn't sing in most of his videos. But it is kind of refreshing to see someone try to make an incredibly complicated and depressing topic at least a little bit entertaining.
But I hope to be a credit someday.
If you really want to know what's behind carbon offsets, the first step is to wrap your mind around the carbon market. First, there's the voluntary carbon market. That's where pretty much anyone can go to buy a carbon credit. You might have also heard of something called compliance markets. Those are the carbon markets that are government regulated, like what the EU has and California has one too. But that's not all. There are also programs like Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, which sets how countries can transfer their carbon credits to help other countries meet their climate targets. If you're thinking, wow, that's a lot, Yes, it is. It's a huge market, and it's worth billions. The compliance market alone, so the government-regulated ones, were worth $909 billion U.S. dollars as of 2022. And by comparison, the voluntary carbon market is actually pretty small. In 2022, it was worth about $2 billion U.S. dollars. That's actually an astounding number, because that's four times what it was worth in 2020. And that's really important to consider because the everyday people buying these carbon offsets are doing so under the assumption that they're doing something that will help slow down climate change. And I'm going to send you three different links.
Real quick, let me pull that up.
I wanted to get another opinion on those websites for offsetting my flight, so I reached out to a climate researcher who's seen the same problems crop up over and over again with carbon offsets for years.
I'm Danny Collingwood, and I'm a senior fellow with the Climate Center for Energy Policy at the University of Pennsylvania.
Is there anything initially that you see where you say, okay, this is legit or this is kind of shady?
I mean, I've seen all of these words before. Part of the problem is there's things I look for as an expert that are usually not presented to consumers, which is what's the project? What's the methodology? I go straight to the technical information because pretty much all of the words around certification and monitoring, it's all nonsense talk. And the only thing that matters are the technical standards. And that's where I need to go to start answering these questions.
So those technical questions Danny once answered really need an expert eye. Let's say the project claims to be protecting a forest from getting cut down. The most important questions are, first, was this forest definitely going to be cut down in the first place? That's what's referred to as additionality. In other words, is the project truly leading to new carbon reductions? The next question Danny and other experts would ask is, what's the baseline? So if the forest gets cut down, how much CO2 would that have released into the atmosphere? And by not cutting it down, how much CO2 would it be storing? Keep in mind, those are only two of the questions Danny says need to be asked. There are many other questions about how long the project will last, whether it will have any knock-on effects to surrounding areas, etc., etc., etc.
It turns out the rules are really hard to write to create sensible market structures and high quality outcomes, because all of these rules are premised on what we call counterfactual baseline scenarios. So you say to somebody, what would you do if I didn't pay you? Were you going to do something bad? Were you going to put pollution in the atmosphere? Were you going to cut down a forest? Well, maybe I can pay you to not do that. And you can't verify what that person says they were going to do. And all of the incentives in these programs are in place for people to exaggerate and sometimes falsify their claims.
So who exactly is writing these rules anyway? First, you have what are called registries. They're generally the ones who are writing the rules and issuing the credits. Then you have the project developers. They create the projects and sell the credits. After that, you have the auditors who make sure the projects comply with the rules. And remember, the registry generally is the one who wrote them. And last but not least, you have the brokers. They buy and sell the credits. Some take a magnifying glass to the projects, like the company Elias worked for, but he says not all of them do that. So there's not really much oversight, if any, and that's a problem, especially considering the top project developers are based in the US and the EU, while most of the forest-based credits are in the global south.
Tropical forests around the world are some of the most important ecosystems. They're being deforested rapidly. There is a serious crisis there. It's also turned out to be one of the most problematic areas of carbon crediting. And there's a really well-documented example. A team of authors published a piece in the scientific journal Science arguing that about almost 95% of the carbon credits that are being sold from these tropical forest projects aren't doing anything. And it's a very interesting finding because they actually found that several of the projects they looked at were making improvements. They were slowing down deforestation. They were having an impact. It's just that the baseline story that they told to earn carbon credits, what they say would have happened if they didn't get paid, was so thoroughly exaggerated that 19 out of 20 of the credits weren't delivering anything real. So you were both supporting a little bit of good, but most of the credits weren't reflecting real climate benefits, and that should give you some sense of how out of whack these standards can get.
But how much CO2 does a tree absorb anyway? Well, it depends on the type of tree. It depends on the age of the tree. Some forests can store over 1,000 tons of CO2 per hectare, while others only about 10. And what about the biggest sticking point of all for scientists? How long can we count on these forests being there, playing their role in carbon removal? Elias points out that the Amazon rainforest has been storing carbon for the last 55 million years or so. Again, he sees people as the problem, not the forest. But carbon offset projects are a mixed bag with problems that go well beyond climate change.
Really, the reason I do what I do is because I don't think in any industry there's such a wide divergence in outcomes. And for example, the nation of Uganda, thanks to one of these projects, is visibly greener from space. So without doubt, these carbon projects can have a really positive impact.
For the record, Danny agrees with this point too.
But at the same time, on the same market, and often being sold by the same carbon broker, you can have carbon projects that are almost entirely fraudulent and have human rights violations inside of them. And one of the ones that I've come across that I don't think has gotten enough attention is an avoided deforestation project in the Congo called Maïdombé.
A few things to note here. Maïdombé is a province in the western part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's an area roughly the size of England, and most of it is covered by forest. The project Elias is referring to is part of the UN's Red Plus program, which stands for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation in Developing Countries.
And this project is set up by a Western project developer based in San Francisco. They've probably earned about $200 million in carbon credits so far. We found the project's claims to be entirely unsubstantiated. We find the credits themselves to be almost entirely fraudulent. So we think that the carbon project itself is getting 8 times more credits than it should, because it's basically protecting a forest that is a swamp forest. It's called a swamp forest. That's the actual name for it. And there's no reason that anyone on the ground would ever have to convert this land. You know, if they converted this land to agriculture, it wouldn't be agriculturally productive. And there's no real timber that you can get off this land because, you know, the trees are not typical commercial timber species. So the credits themselves we found are bad. But what's even worse is what's taking place inside this $200 million project. Because about 10 years after the project was started, a group of reporters and a nonprofit group went and visited the site. And the first thing that they encountered was that the project developer, again, this American company, tried to bribe the local officials, the local police, to arrest them for interviewing people. And, you know, we just have the word of this these group of reporters that this happened, but it seems fairly likely that this may have occurred. When they were able to interview people, what they found was that 68% of people living inside this project didn't even know they were inside of a carbon project. So these people are supposed to be stopping deforestation in and around their houses. They didn't even know that they were part of this. 94% of people inside the project didn't even know they were entitled to some chunk of this $200 million. And the actual revenue sharing ended up being, after 10 years, somewhere between 10 and 78 cents.
Sorry, and you said people got, I'm sorry, did I understand you correctly, 70 cents?
Because these projects often don't disclose really basic stuff like how much money they're paying to people, the conclusions of that report found that somewhere between 10 and 78 cents per person after 10 years had been distributed on the ground.
A quick correction. It was actually between 10 and 76 cents, not 78 cents. Those numbers come from a 2020 report by the Rainforest Foundation UK.
The worst part may be that because this American project developer doled out the money, what little money they did actually share, they shared very unequally. So they shared it with some communities and not others. And that caused violence between the communities that had received a little bit of the benefits, very small percentages, and communities that had received nothing. So there were widespread human rights violations inside this project in which the carbon credits themselves hadn't been doing anything for anybody.
So remind me again why you think it's good to buy carbon credits. How do you have faith in this kind of scheme?
I have zero faith in the system getting it right, but there are groups that do get it right. So the reason I still work in this space is because I have seen it work. And so my own company's numbers estimate that about 75% of the nature-based credits that we've evaluated, we don't think are doing anything. That's really terrible, right? But it does still leave hundreds of millions of tons that have done something. And so the reason I still keep doing this is that the industry could be fixed if it were regulated. If common sense rules were put in place, it could work. And I know this because I have seen it work a lot of times. It just doesn't work the majority of times.
That's Elias Airy, a carbon markets expert, speaking with GW's Kathleen Schuster. If all this throws cold water in an idea that you like and even practice, Kathleen offers this bit of advice.
So I would say, if you're dead set on buying a carbon offset, whatever it is that you want to offset, the first thing you should do after maybe figuring out where you want to buy an offset is to Google the project that you find and see if there's been anything written about it, whether it's, you know, problems with deforestation or a project that was already in the works and this is just kind of, you know, smoke and mirrors or human rights violations. So that would be the smartest thing to do is you have to do a little bit of research on your own.
And one final thought on carbon markets.
At the end of the day, if we want to do something about CO2, we actually have to reduce emissions. We can't just transfer the problem somewhere else in the world and say, okay, I'm going to be good now and you can be bad and you can be bad and I can be good. We really have to reduce emissions in a real way. Otherwise, the problem will just continue to grow with climate change.
Find more reporting from our partners at Deutsche Welle on our website, theworld.org/DW.
Speaking of carbon credits from airlines, here's a track called Flying. Maori Drum set the mood before surrendering to a Brazilian vibe.
From the island nation of Aotearoa, better known as New Zealand, this is the Auckland-based jazz collective, The Circling Sun.
Strong elements of Maori and Brazilian sounds, and with this track, a nod to Japan. The flowing rhythm echoes the meaning of its title. Mizu, in Japanese, means water.
It's the Circling Sun's take on samba jazz. The ensemble's members are some of New Zealand's best-known session musicians. They're joined with lush vocals from Love Affinity Choir. And their simple refrain, "Love's Fading Away, I Always Turn to Yesterday."
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Yevgeny Prigozhin was once a close ally of Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Prigozhin ran the private Russian military company, the Wagner Group. But 2 years ago this week, the notorious militia commander died in a mysterious plane crash.
That crash of a private plane happened soon after Prigozhin attempted a stunning rebellion against the Russian military, marching his Wagner troops toward Moscow and creating hours of confusion and alarm across Russia. Here's Yevgeny Prigozhin himself speaking the following day. In a video posted online, Prigozhin tried to describe the short-lived uprising as a protest, not an attempted coup.
But by the end of summer, he was dead. And questions grew about who would take command over the Wagner Group. These events in Russia 2 years ago have had serious repercussions in countries where Wagner mercenaries operated. Case in point, Mali in West Africa.
A new report out today describes Wagner forces there in the aftermath of Prigozhin's death going into a full-blown meltdown. Justina Gudzowska is the executive director of The Sentry, an investigative organization tracking corruption that released this report.
Wagner has been in Africa since around 2017, and it has established footholds in Sudan, the Central African Republic, and is really trying to spread its influence across Africa. especially as it was losing friends around the world because of its actions in Ukraine. So when it first went into Mali at the end of 2021, beginning of 2022, it went in there ostensibly to fight terrorism, but its purpose really was to expand Russia's influence in Africa and to gain access to natural resources, as it had been able to do in places like Sudan and Central African Republic.
Mm. So 2021, 2022, was Wagner invited at the behest of the Malian junta after they kicked French troops out?
Yes. Wagner was seen as perhaps a partner for these countries that asked fewer questions about human rights abuses, about the anti-democratic records of these countries, and were seen at that point as a very fearsome fighting force. The Malian junta thought that Wagner would be willing to take more risks than, for example, the French.
So what exactly went wrong in Mali?
Well, a number of things went wrong in Mali. First of all, they went in as a counterterrorism force, but they failed miserably on that front. And actually, violence is on the rise in Mali. JNIM, the very fierce terrorist group that's Al-Qaeda affiliate, has been doing better and better. Furthermore, they've just caused friction within the Malian military itself, known as FAMA, partially because of Wagner's brutality. There's been a lot of tension. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, Wagner has not been able to gain access to natural resources in the way it did in Central African Republic and Sudan. And Mali is a very gold-rich country, and they failed miserably on that front as well.
Did Wagner not understand the dynamics of the battlefield in Mali? I mean, why was it different from what they'd experienced elsewhere in Africa?
I think they probably underestimated kind of how tough it is, the battlefield in Mali. There's a lot of armed groups. It's a very large country with difficult terrain. To really be able to cover Mali, you need air support, and they didn't get that as well. So I think they went in a little bit cocky and quickly learned that this wasn't going to be easy.
So how has Mali's military government reacted to all of this?
One of the recent developments is that in June, Wagner claimed mission accomplished in Mali and was going to be replaced with the Africa Corps. Russia seems to be doubling down. They're not leaving. It's creating tensions within the Malian junta. So this is something we're watching very closely because it's really developing in real time. It's also the violence perpetrated by Wagner. Wherever Wagner goes, civilian deaths increase. It's extremely brutal organization, have also caused splits within the Malian military, with certain officers really being against some of this more extreme violence.
I mean, your report spoke about the Wagner situation kind of instilling paranoia within the military junta in Mali. Is that kind of how it's manifesting itself?
Yes, for sure. You know, there is definitely tension also because Wagner seems to be favored over the military. Wagner doesn't treat the Malian military like partners. They treat them like subordinates. They're very racist also towards the Malian military. Because of this brutality, the Malian military has lost their network of informants because they're no longer trusted. So it's really leading to chaos. You know, Wagner has been an agent of chaos in Mali.
I'm really curious to know what sort of an impact Wagner's presence has had on ordinary people in Mali. What did you find out?
Terrible. So the biggest impact has been felt by the civilians. It's really been a downward spiral of violence at the hands of Wagner and the Malian military, but it's also contributing to the jihadist threat. Wagner is a fantastic recruitment tool for terrorist groups, and JNIM, the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Mali, has said as much. Plus, the terrorist groups themselves have retaliated. So this has been hugely detrimental to civilians in Mali.
So if the failure of Wagner has only strengthened the jihadist movements in the region, what does that mean now strategically? in terms of what needs to be done to keep them in check? Like, what are the options for the junta in Mali?
That's a great question. I think, I think what this report shows, it's a buyer's beware. Russia is not a reliable counterterrorism partner. So I think Mali needs to think about other potential partners. And one initial step that it could take is rejoin ECOWAS, which is the bloc of West African states. You know, the regional cooperation on this threat becomes very, very critical. And Mali, because of the junta, because of the coup, along with Burkina Faso and Niger, who have also called in Russia, have left that regional bloc.
That's Justyna Gudzowska. She's the executive director of the Sentry. It's got a report out today that tracks the failure of the Wagner Group to battle jihadists in Mali over the past 2 years. Justyna joined us from New York.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Dodi and Billy Crockett, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Lynn and Bruce Dayton. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.